Hello everyone and welcome back to episode 215 of your favourite Formula One show. Yes, Knowing Wheel returns. We're still in the depths of the winter break, so Jamie and I thought we're gonna finally wrap up our iceberg series. Yes, of course we're in the depths of winter, so therefore we're heading into the depths of the iceberg. But first of all, Jamie, how are we, sir?
I'm doing well, yes. I was just gonna research when we started this iceberg.
I'm pretty certain it was last summer. When we were bored during the summer break.
I don't know if it could have been a time where we were uploading two different places, but it says 29th of December 2023. So that's only just over a year ago, but it feels longer than that.
Did but we start finally, this a year ago?
Finally, we have finished. Well, after today, we'll have finished.
Yes.
And as usual with the icebergs, we'll be covering some pretty heavy topics, so viewer discretion is advised. Last time we spent about an hour talking about different drivers' deaths, so hopefully it'll be slightly more cheery than that, but it's mixed. Some of them are quite entertaining, some of them are just dark, so yeah.
But none of them this time round include death. Well, one of them kind of, but not necessarily. Not exactly.
No. Yeah.
But as always, when we do these icebergs, we do say, you know, these aren't for the faint of heart. There are quite a few kind of darker topics within them as well, which is, you know, just the nature of the beast, if you will, because these are often the topics that, you know, get hidden away, get forgotten about.
Brushed under the carpet as quickly.
Exactly, get brushed under the carpet. So, Jamie, we've got six to get through today. Where do you fancy starting off, sir?
I reckon we'll start for the most recent one, which
okay.
was news to me when I saw that when I did the
staggeringly, Jamie had not heard of this one.
Yes, because it relates to the 2022 Belgian Grand Prix, which is a race I was at. So I'm quite surprised that it had all gone away by the time the race actually came around. But basically, in the off season in March of 2022, so we're literally talking 3 years ago. You know, Verstappen's just won his first championship, beating Lewis Hamilton at Abu Dhabi, get that one in there straight away. And yeah, there was an organization, you would call them a terrorist organization, because they are one, in Belgium, who sent a letter to a local paper claiming that unless they halt the race, unless FOCA, the Formula One,
Championship Association, isn't it?
Oh, yes. So unless FOCA cancel the race, the Belgian Grand Prix that year, then they would attempt to halt it, which they didn't give detail, but with the history of this group, it sounded like a bomb threat, which obviously needs to be taken very seriously. But local police weren't sure if it was a hoax or if it was real. This was in March, and they claimed that, yeah, they would attempt to halt the race unless they cancelled it and gave them 10 million Belgian francs from Bernie Eccleston himself, who wasn't really involved in the running of Formula One at this point. He was just kind of around. And this was in response to the US anti-terrorism stuff that was going on at the time. And surprisingly, I didn't know about this before about half an hour ago, despite attending this race in Belgium in 2022. So obviously it was a hoax, or they gave up on their plan, whichever way you prefer. But there would have been higher security, I'm sure. They did tell me to take my water bottle back to the campsite because I wasn't allowed it in the facility, which is quite annoying, thinking back.
That's quite common, though, isn't it? What I want to know, as someone that used to deal with foreign currency, Belgian francs don't exist anymore, do they? I thought Belgium uses the euro.
Oh, yeah. Belgium does use the euro. So I wonder,
are they going to get 10 million... francs? I mean, what is 10 million Belgian francs worth, do we even know?
So like, there are Belgian francs, they do exist, because I think the Flemish reason, I guess you can use both. One Belgian franc is...
Yep.
No, this is euros. What the heck?
This is what confused me when you started saying that.
One Belgian franc is 2 pence.
Okay, so they wanted, what's that, 50 grand?
They wanted 20 grand.
20 grand. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, how
I think.
Odd.
But who knew that a Belgian franc was still a thing? And maybe it wasn't. It could have just been a complete hoax, and they were just, like, waffling the whole time just to freak people out. So
Yeah, very odd. I'm going to deal immediately then, Jamie, with probably the darkest one I've got on this list. Of course, I mean, it feels like this is one of those stories that is just never going to leave the news, is it? In all of its kind of various guises. But of course, obviously, somehow if you've been living under a rock, obviously Jeffrey Epstein, obviously famous socialite in New York for a long time. And then, of course, now only known for his... I mean, there's no other way of wording it. It was a child sex ring. And of course, the big kind of story that's come off from that, apart from him dying in prison in incredibly controversial circumstances, was obviously his little black book. Because obviously a lot of famous people would go to his island, and there's no evidence to suggest that obviously any of this went on whilst people were at his island, but also there was a lot of people going to that island a lot of the time. So there's kind of five names from the Formula One world that have been kind of tied to this and mentioned in Jeffrey Epstein's books. I would argue Bernie Eccleston and Flavio Briatore. Again, I'm not accusing them personally of anything, but they know a lot of very rich people, don't they, the pair of them? So they were both mentioned.
Quite a lot.
Exactly. Lawrence Stroll, of course, another billionaire from North America, was also mentioned having travelled to the island. Perhaps slightly more interestingly, though, Jamie, is both Jacques Villeneuve and Eddie Irvine.
Really?
Who Eddie Irvine actually became very wealthy in his retirement as a luxury real estate developer. So
didn't know that.
Yeah, you
wonder. He's probably
quite
wealthy as a Ferrari driver as well, you'd imagine.
But he wasn't a Ferrari driver for that long, or at a time where Ferrari were paying big money.
True. Yes, and like we say, we're not saying if you went to the island, you therefore you're a sex offender. But it's not a list you want to be on, is it? And it's a big shame that those people are now kind of caught up in all the mess that has happened.
Well, the legal proceedings that seemingly are just never going to go through, are they?
No, even though he's been dead for 6 years now. So, lovely cheery topic as always. I will continue that with a man called Clay Regazzoni, who stars in Rush, which is how most people might have heard of him. He was Niki Lauda's teammate when he was at Ferrari. This is F1 in the 70s, so James Hunt's around, you know. It's all about, sex, breakfast of champions and that kind of thing. It was so, so overdone at the time. The glamour has kind of gone away a little bit. I mean, you call it glamour, well, it's basically just...
It was all about the danger, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Formula One at this time. It was all about, these guys are rock stars, basically, wasn't it?
Yeah. So there's a Vogue issue from the 70s, including Clay Regazzoni, who was a pretty, typical, like, macho-looking guy, Argentinian, long hair, big moustache, proper 70s. But sadly, on this, well, looking back, I guess at the time it was quite normal, but there's a picture on the cover of Vogue of Clay Regazzoni basically sexually assaulting the model who he's with on there. And obviously, I'm sure it was done by producers, and this is just a product of its time in a way, but it's also really, really bad.
It's one of those things that's aged terribly.
Yes. And I'm not saying Clay Regazzoni is a sex offender, but in hindsight, this is a very, very bad idea. I wouldn't recommend Googling the image, but it's basically him and a woman rubbed up against each other, and hands are where you shouldn't expect hands to be for two professionals doing a photo shoot.
Or any two people that aren't married, Jamie.
Exactly, yeah. So, that's another cheery one. Hopefully we've got all the darkness out of the way. And we can move on to much cheerier bottom of the iceberg topics, I'm sure.
Well, I think cheerier is probably a little bit strong, based on obviously what we've got left to go through on the iceberg. I will go to one that probably is not a positive, I would argue, but he's certainly not as dark as a lot of the other ones we've gone through on today's show, and that is Phoenix Finance, which, considering this was the early 2000s, and this was kind of the era of big money and big dreams in Formula One, and obviously Ferrari just absolutely, you know, there were so many storylines in the early 2000s, wasn't there, Jamie? Between Toyota, you know, coming in, Jaguar coming in, you know, so much money being thrown around. And of course, all of those stories were wrecked by Michael Schumacher and Ferrari and the dominance throughout those 5 years from 2000 to 2004. Obviously, a couple of those years weren't so dominant, but he did win all five world titles, as we all well know. But this actually is looking at the other end of the grid, because obviously when Prost went bankrupt towards the end of 2001, it was a company called Phoenix Finance that bought most of the remains of the Prost Grand Prix team. So Paul Stoddart from Minardi, we love Paul Stoddart.
Oh, he was actually a legend.
Exactly. He was trying to obviously buy a lot of these parts, you know, cheap ex-Formula One parts. You know, they're just useful for other teams. At this time, to kind of work out what other teams are doing with their car, and also, you know, just to use the materials and things like that. Because selling a Formula One, like, car and resources and things, you're in quite a limited market, aren't you, Jamie? If you've gone bankrupt, the only people that are buying Formula One, like, components and machinery and things like that are other Formula One teams. So Paul Stoddart was obviously trying to buy a lot of this. But he got outbeat by this company called Phoenix Finance, who bought all of the Prost AP04 chassis, which were used in 2001, and the Hart Design Arrows V10 engines, which had been used from 1998. Allegedly, Craig Pollock was going to come on board as the new team principal for the team, but the
They were planning to go into 2002. With an engine from 1998.
Yes, and a car that was basically already last in 2001. The year before. Exactly.
And it wasn't an engine freeze at this point. They were just 4-5 years behind the curve.
Yeah, I mean, engines weren't going up in power massively year on year. In fact, there did seem to be quite a bit of movement kind of up and down. It was more about the reliability and things at this point.
Still, can't be great for you, can it?
But basically, Phoenix, obviously, their plan was to race under the Prost name in 2002 to basically just circumvent having to pay the new team entry fee in the Formula One, which, I mean, now is, like, we reckon, what, $500 million? 25 years ago, or just under 25 years ago, it was only $50 million.
Bargain. Let's do it.
So, obviously, the plan was, you know, get in, race as Prost, effectively, for a few Grand Prix, and then just change your name to Phoenix, or whatever they were going to call it. Formula One kind of saw past this and went, that's not happening. And Bernie Ecclestone famously at the time said he has brought nothing to Formula One. All he has bought is some show-off cars, which Phoenix didn't take too kindly to. So they tried to show up for the Australian Grand Prix, got turned away at the gate. They'd hired both of the former Minardi drivers of Tasso Marquez and Gaston Mazzacane, who I'm sure, of course, would have been bringing money as well to the team. They then got to Sepang for round two of the year with all their engineers, both cars, and their two drivers, and again were not allowed in. So the team then took the FIA to High Court, but the court backed the FIA's ruling that the team injuries, obviously, they weren't Prost, and even better than that, they told them they weren't allowed to sell the parts. They just had to accept the loss.
That seems a bit difficult, a bit harsh.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's harsh that they were denied entry.
I think this was Formula One, obviously, at this point now, basically just trying to stop this from repeatedly happening.
They were just like, do one. We're not dealing with you anymore. But I do totally see why they weren't allowed in. Because they are a new entry, whether they like it or not. And, yeah, they were trying to circumvent the $50 million entry fee by basically, like, pulling a front up of being Prost. I can see why they were denied entry. The fact is that it wasn't decided, as in they hadn't, maybe they had a hard answer, but clearly they thought they could convince them otherwise at Australia. Is mental. That must have cost a fortune to ship all your assets there just to get turned away.
Well, you think as well, isn't it? It must have been that idea of, well, if we get there, they surely won't turn us away. They'll just let us in, won't they? And, you know, you think, what, 5 years prior, you had MasterCard Lola rocket up with a car that was basically non-apparent. Yeah. Also, fun fact, Jamie, Michelin and Bridgestone had both declined to offer them tyres for the season, so apparently they were going to be running Avon tyres.
Was that allowed? I guess it was any tyre manufacturer, wasn't it?
There was no restrictions on tyre manufacturer, so they're going to be bringing Avon tyres in.
Wow. I just thought Avon was a river.
Yeah, but basically is.
Yeah, well, I think even if they were allowed entry, we wouldn't have seen much of them regardless, based on that management.
No, I mean, the Prost car of 2001 was not great. I mean, no. If I just have a quick look back through 2001, the Prost scored 4 points, admittedly. Sixth place.
Yolo Trulli?
No, he was not even in the car in 2001.
Ah. He drove a Prost at some point.
He did, 1997 and 1998.
Yeah, not far away.
No, sorry, that was kind of Prost, but not really in 97. It was Prost, sorry, ignore me, because obviously that's when Olivier Panis was looking like a genuine championship threat early on in the year. But yeah, 2001, Jean Alesi scored 4 points for the team, Frentzen didn't score, Gaston Mazzucane didn't score, Luciano Berti didn't score, and Thomas Enger, who has a fascinating story of his own in the world of Formula One, for getting tested positive, I think, for cocaine at some point as well, so was banned from the sport.
So yeah, five drivers and 4 points, that's quite impressive.
That's
like HRT levels.
Yeah, that was almost Sauber last year.
Yeah.
Two drivers, no points.
Yeah, true.
So, I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, to be fair to Prost, they did actually beat both Arrows and Minardi. So I think that's why Minardi were trying to buy those parts in 2002.
Because obviously, people thought, upgrades.
Exactly. You think, again, just a very cheap way of doing it in the grand scheme of things. But anyway, yeah, Phoenix, I think what's kind of interesting about this was obviously we had all of these different stories going around in the early 2000s of so many different teams that were trying to get in, or, you know, corporate buyouts, or, you know, car manufacturers getting in. And this one kind of feels like it got swept under the rug, because a lot of people kind of forget that Alain Prost had a Formula One team.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bit of a short-term affair, wasn't it? And they ended up in liquidation. Obviously, they weren't bought out by Phoenix. So, yeah. Whereas Jackie Stewart was on the grid briefly in the late 90s, early 2000s as well.
Yeah, and he did a fantastic job. Exactly.
And then Jaguar is now Red Bull Racing, so that's gone well.
Yeah, it's always funny, isn't it, the way these things turn around down the line. But anyway, yeah Phoenix Finance, a very weird tale, tale of the early 2000s.
Indeed. My next one's really fun, and it's absolutely ridiculous. So let's check yourselves in.
Yeah, prepare, this is a story.
Right, so picture the scene. It's 1963. You've just finished racing in Zandvoort, and it's a Sunday night, obviously, and the FIA have arranged the French Grand Prix, which is the next round of the championship, at Reims, or that's definitely not spelled right, but Rem, which is near where Pierre Gasly was born, funnily enough, the closest circuit to his place of birth. And the racing kicks off in Rem on the Wednesday after the Dutch Grand Prix. So they've got to, obviously, it's the 60s, so it's a lot less well-organized than F1 is now, and they've got to be ready for the practice session to start on the Wednesday of the same week. Jim Clark had just got a Grand Chelem at
I was going to say, I'm sure Jim Clark won that race at Zandvoort.
Yes, he did. And the point of the iceberg is the Graham Hill 96-3 French Grand Prix penalty. We'll get to that. There's a few things before that.
I mean, it should have just been the 1963 French Grand Prix. I mean,
yes.
Did we actually work out why the Grand Prix was held so early in the end, Jamie?
It was something to do with the region of France, which is Champagne region. I think it was to do with the Sunday. Basically, they refused to race on the Sunday.
They won't allow the race to happen. It's because the French love a strike. That's why.
So, obviously, that meant that everything had to come forward. I don't know why I had to come forward so much. But regardless, they had practice on Wednesday. They had qualifying was on Friday, I believe. And then the race, yeah. But basically, people were like, we could just push it back. Let's just screw the French. But they didn't do it. And practice did go ahead on the Wednesday. But the next piece of interest is on Grand Prix Sunday.
And Saturday in this case.
Yes, exactly. Grand Prix day. I'm not entirely sure what day it was, if I'm And yeah, so you've got... Actually, I've missed Saturday. That was quite funny as well. Joe Siffert, who was a Swiss racing driver back in the day, on the Saturday, was provisionally on pole position, briefly, because he set a lap time with an average speed of over 250 miles an hour. Which, for context, the cars nowadays top out at about 220 on Mexico.
Yeah, an average lap speed in a Formula One car now is about 150 on a quick track.
So in the 60s, they're saying he said he briefly measured a lap of 250 miles an hour average.
Reims was admittedly a fairly quick track, wasn't it? But not 250 miles an hour quick.
No, exactly. And this was because there was a Formula Junior, so a support race, effectively F2, back in the day, on track during F1 qualifying. So, mismanagement, I believe. So he starts his lap, they start a stopwatch. This other car that's not even a Formula One car comes across the line and they just stop the stopwatch. And then, obviously, he's not finished his lap, so he's basically shortened it. And it registered that he did a lap of 250 miles an hour average. Didn't happen. Jim Clark was actually on pole position.
Of course he was.
2 minutes, 21 seconds. And then we got to the race. And you've got Jim Clark on pole, Graham Hill in second place. And the race is getting underway. But as the start procedure is going on, which at this point isn't lights, obviously, because it's the 60s, you've got a guy with a flag. The guy with the flag sees that Graham Hill is waving his hands and like, no, I've stalled the car. I can't start the race. Usually, this was quite common back in the day. Usually, they would start anyway and then basically the stalled car is a lap down, as is the case now, really, if they don't notice the staller. But this didn't happen because clearly the FIA were trying to... get a title fight going between Hill and Jim Clark. And the FIA guy with the flag decided that they shouldn't start the race, so he abandoned the start. Obviously no one goes anywhere because he hasn't lowered the flag, and then the BRM mechanics, which is not procedure, all just sprint onto the track to push Graham Hill back into place because he's edged forward a little bit, which is totally not allowed, as you would expect, despite it being the 60s. And then as soon as the car is back in position, the usual procedure would be to do an extra formation lap, which is remarkably similar to what we have now. But the guy with the flag didn't fancy that. He just raised his flag to start the race, except that he used the red flag instead of the green flag by accident, which is just ridiculous. It's so French. It's unbelievable.
I mean, they must have all been drunk on champagne.
Honestly,
it's the only logical explanation.
Or they were just so tired from having to get from Zandvoort to Rem on a 2-day turnaround.
It's not that far, though.
No, it's literally, it's like 4 hours, probably, isn't it?
I was going to say, even back then, it can't have been that bad.
So he accidentally raised the red flag to start the race, which is classic. All drivers actually had to stop immediately. But this wasn't obeyed. Everyone just went, because everyone knew that it was a mistake. So they just started the race. Apart from... Maston Gregory, who is a, I believe, Belgian racing driver, and Phil Hill. So another, just to confuse things even more, you've got another Hill on the grid.
Another world champion Hill.
Exactly. But here's another thing, just to add insult to injury. They didn't obey the red flag. They were just so confused that they both accidentally stalled as well. So they were trying to start the race like everyone else and just stalled their cars. Fast forward to... the end of the race, the FIA confirmed that nobody would be punished for starting the race under a red flag. Basically, they admitted, look, we messed up. And then they eventually announced mid-race that Graham Hill, for the infringement where his mechanics ran onto the track, would get a 1-minute penalty, which sounds a lot, but in those days, it really wasn't, because quite often, the winner would be the only car on the lead lap. So you'd have like...
I would say Jim Clark won a race around this time by 5 minutes, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So it's probably the equivalent of like a 10-second stop-go penalty or 10-second time penalty these days, kind of that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not very much for your mechanics running onto the track during a start procedure.
Well, because he would have been out of it.
Yeah, he would have been out of the race completely. So Brabham, who was the team behind BRM, behind Graham Hill. So Graham Hill eventually finished third. You got Brabham's in fourth and fifth. They were like, no, we need a bigger penalty because they want the podium. They missed out on the podium by 2 seconds after the minute was applied, which is quite unlucky. And then after the race, the FIA decided they would apply a bigger penalty to Graham Hill. But for whatever reason, they didn't apply more time. They just took his points off him. Which, how do you end up at that? I've no idea.
So no one technically got third place points from this race?
No, yes. So Graham Hill was classified third. He got to keep his trophy. But no points were awarded to him. He just lost the 4 points that he would have earned for finishing third. So Jack Brabham and Jan Gurney, who were driving the Brabham cars, still only got 3 points and 2 points for finishing fourth and fifth, despite the FIA effectively disqualifying the driver in third, but without removing him from the classifications. It's just a right mess. And the fact that all of this, after they started the race by waving a red flag, it's just hilarious, to be honest. And F1 60 sounds like a right laugh.
Oh, it was just been chaos, wasn't it? I mean, it reminds me of, I think it was the early 70s NASCAR. They had, I think it was at Bowman Gray, they had issues like this where... To put it in Formula 1 context where you'll understand it, Jamie, for whatever reason, the F2 cars were quicker than the Formula 1 cars.
Right.
So one of the Formula 1 drivers drove an F2 car, won. So in the end, they just gave nobody the win. And right. This is, genuinely, a couple of months ago, they finally gave Bobby Allison the win for it. So it had been
in the 70s?
From 1971. So it had been a Stewart's inquiry for 54 years.
That's hilarious.
And they finally gave it to him.
Wow. And also, Jim Clark just drove his own race, got another Grand Clem, and went on to win the championship. So that was the year he won basically everything in 1963.
Is that where he scored maximum points? Like maximum available points because there was drop rounds and everything? So he scored every point he could.
And he also won like the New Zealand Grand Prix series before the season even started, and won F2, and won Indy 500.
And won like British touring cars, and basically anything Jim Clark touched, he was just goated at. It was insane.
Yes.
And definitely a proper top five F1 driver of all time. Absolutely. Absolutely. That one was a fantastic. Say, Jamie obviously was doing research before this, and we were trying to decipher it. I mean, this is like the most French 1960s thing we've ever heard of.
There was so much going on.
Wild.
But one thing's consistent is that the FIA cannot apply penalties consistently. That is in the heritage.
Nothing's
in the
changed.
DNA.
Oh, it's just Formula One, isn't it? Our final one, though, Jamie, ever. I mean, we might end up doing another iceberg at some time soon. But our final ever iceberg topic from the original iceberg we've done on the channel is the 1973 South African GP yellow flags. And I'll be honest, we probably should have ended on your Graham Hill one, because it's a bit more of a funny story.
Right.
In the end. But the 1973 South African Grand Prix, unfortunately, featured a massive crash before the race even got underway in qualifying. It was Jackie Stewart's teammate, Francois Sever, who had a total brake failure in qualifying. So brakes just completely went. So Jackie Stewart replaced him in that car. Jackie Stewart had the complete brake failure, so he took Sever's car for the race.
So we've got an Alban Sargeant situation.
Exactly. Basically, yeah, that. But race start went okay, but it was on lap 3 where we saw Clay Regazzoni had an accident. Exactly, yeah, he's all over the place. He had contact with Mike Hailwood, who collided with his BRM, which was on fire, and the crash was so severe that it knocked Regazzoni out immediately. But luckily, Mike Hailwood, not knocked out from the collision, managed to get out of his car, ran back up the track and got Clay Regazzoni out of his burning car. So only suffered minor burns from this. And was
and
made
this
a
is
very
also
speedy
a time
recovery.
Before marshals had fire suits as well.
Yes,
because
exactly.
They were introduced after Lauda's crash at the Nürburgring, weren't they? So
yes.
Only the drivers could have helped at this situation,
exactly.
Which is insane still.
It did take him over three laps to try and get Regazzoni out of the wreckage. And whilst this was all taking place, Jackie Stewart, who ended up seventh on the grid, managed to go all the way to first place, partly down to the fact that Denny Hulme, in his McLaren, ran over some of the wreckage from Clay Regazzoni's BRM and had to make a pit stop because he had a puncture. Stewart apparently passed at least three yellow cars under a yellow flag whilst all this was going on, including Jody Scheckter, who obviously was, you know, South African. It was his second ever Grand Prix, and he was, you know, fighting for the lead, which was absolutely impressive. But basically, it just boiled down to the fact that yellow flags were a thing, but they weren't really enforced, and drivers would still potentially overtake and things like this. So after the Grand Prix, Teddy Mayer, who some of you might know, obviously his son now has been in some of the controversy recently for being a steward in Formula One, obviously filed an official protest against Jackie Stewart after the Grand Prix. The stewards of the meeting listened to the various sides of the story, and after due consideration, severely reprimanded Jackie Stewart, who will always deny the regulations. He's always adamant, even to this day, that he didn't do anything wrong. But it doesn't say what they severely reprimanded him with, because he kept the win. But bizarrely, it says, one wonders, had it been Regazzoni, Reutemann or Scheckter, or someone like that who had committed the same offence, whether the decision would have been disqualification from the race.
British bias was well enforced in the 70s.
Exactly,
and the late 60s.
Exactly. In fact, in the saloon car race that followed the Grand Prix, a driver was disqualified for overtaking under a yellow flag as well, which probably did not do them any favours in the end. But of course, 1973, I believe. Exactly, I believe it was obviously Stewart's. Yeah, it was his last world title, wasn't
it
as well?
Yeah.
In 1973. And Lotus, because of this result, led Tyrrell by just a single point as well.
Yes, and he won by 24.5 seconds.
You might think three laps is not a particularly big circuit. Kyle Army back then apparently was 24 miles.
I don't buy that. So I'm looking at the qualifying time for that race, and it was 1 minute 16.
Well,
that can't
possibly
be right.
I'm guessing it means 2.4 miles? Because I looked at that and thought that doesn't look right either. But again, trying to get information from these stories back in the day can be quite difficult. But yeah, there we go. Jackie Stewart. Did he cheat? Did he not? He will probably take it to his grave.
Take that to the grave, yes.
Exactly.
Yes. What is your favourite? I mean, I'll put you on the spot. Of all of our iceberg, there's so many things on this iceberg.
I'm just having a look through and trying to remember, because obviously there's, I mean, it depends how you kind of define favourite, doesn't it? Because some of them obviously were fantastic, and some of them obviously were utterly bizarre. I think the question I want to ask, Jamie, is which one would you love to know the truth behind?
I would love to know what happened to that diamond in the Jaguar nose cone in Monaco.
That is definitely right up there. I think the other one is...
Part of me feels like that was marketing. Part of me was like, they planned this. Obviously, they didn't plan for him to crash, but some bright spark in the marketing department was like, right, he's crashed. Let's remove the diamond. Then we can make it all this controversy
exactly.
about it.
Mystery. I think always the big one for me is like, you know, I think we'd all just want to know what went wrong on Senna's car. The James Courtney Jaguar test as well. Absolutely fascinates me, because that was such a massive crash and kind of
was
what went wrong there.
Electrocution on here? I don't think it was.
No,
was it? I want to know what happened there.
Yeah, no, we definitely want to know that one as well, don't we? And I think the other one that I just saw again that was probably the funniest one was definitely the 1960 Italian GP boycott. The fact that Ferrari were terrible that year, but good in a straight line. So Monza just did the fastest track they could to give Ferrari a chance.
Yeah. I feel like that is the sort of thing that would happen still, to be honest.
Most likely.
Also, the Williams 2012 Spanish Grand Prix. Because
oh yes,
they definitely set fire to the garage to burn evidence. I'm sure of it. I am so sure of it. Because Maldonado
did that car
won.
Have traction control? Oh, the thing Maldonado, is though, that Williams car was genuinely good that year.
But it was good at certain circuits, and Spain, as in the type of circuit Spain wasn't one of them.
But it was good at Singapore as well, which is similar. Like Maldonado qualified Valencia, on the front row there, yeah. Didn't he? Yeah. It is one of those ones that it feels like as time has gone on, you kind of go, 2012 was so wide open, I feel like it must have been the perfect storm. Or they knew that would be the weekend where they could try and cheat something out of it and it would look believable.
And then burn the other car to find the evidence.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. The Alonso 2006 Monza quality penalty was a good one as well. Well,
oh, that was
funny. To win the championship, so just exactly. Gave a second per qualifying exactly. session, which is unprecedented.
Yes, yeah. Andrea Moda, that was definitely a highlight as well. One of the wildest ever F1 teams. And, I mean, we want to do more of these kind of things, don't we, Jamie, down the line?
We do.
We want to talk about, like,
someone
random...
else to make a graphic for us.
Well, not even that, but we want to do, like, stories about, like, the early 2000s and things like that as well. And all these kind of things. I'd love for us to be able to do, like, a conspiracy
side. What I'd
of
want
the show.
Is someone who is in the know to come on the podcast and tell us...
That
tell
would
us
be
the
great.
Truth. About like
that would be great. The Benetton traction
these,
control.
Well, that was just Schumacher being an unbelievable driver, but you know.
I mean, it's been confirmed apparently by people inside Benetton that it was definitely running traction.
Yeah,
control.
And denied by other people inside Benetton. I'd buy them.
Oh really? Wait, so you're serious? It was in the files.
I listened to.
Right, I'm
going to
give you
the guy's
two
name.
Words here, Jamie. Yeah, I'm going to give you two words okay. here. Flavio Briatore.
It's true. But I listened to a podcast on Beyond the Grid with a Benetton mechanic. I think it was the one who had, they call him Spanners or something. Or
oh, yeah, yeah.
Whatever. It's not Spanners. It's something like that where it's a tool that is just his name for some reason. He works at Mercedes now. Or still, I guess it's the same team, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
is
they...
No, Benetton
became
is
Renault.
Mercedes.
Renault.
Yeah.
He was basically like, look, that car didn't have traction control. You can ask Ross Brawn about it.
He'd say that, though, wouldn't he? They'd all say that. Schumacher can't go back down to 6 world titles. That's what they're worried about.
Well, he should be up to 8, really, shouldn't he?
Well, I was thinking about this a couple of days ago, Jamie. Or I actually did some research on this, talking about 8th world titles. Underrated one, Hamilton, Barcelona, 2010 puncture.
What, you think that was a sniper in the crowd trying to help a lot?
No, no, I'm not saying it was a sniper in the crowd. But people talk, obviously, about all the lost opportunities. Had he not got that puncture and everyone behind him finished where they did, he would have been world champion that year.
Yeah, but you can argue that Abu Dhabi would have played out differently because Alonso wouldn't have been caring about Weber so much. So it's all a bit hypothetical. But yes.
It's all hypothetical, but it's still interesting to think about because that's kind
of
like the
claim
forgotten
your
one.
12th world championship for Lewis Hamilton. I'm sorry.
that would be absolutely 12 world titles in 18 years. Would be
well, he hasn't got
so...
12, has he? He's got 7.
No,
so...
but if he had. So insane, so insane. But, I mean, there we go. Iceberg completed. I'm pretty certain we started this last summer.
I think we
started
well.
This last winter.
We're going
to
do
we
a supercar.
We just had it ready to go.
So...
Yeah, we are going to do a supercar. I might try and get that out later on this week.
That'll be very long. But you can go back and revisit how different and young we looked 18 months ago.
What, 6 months ago? No, it was last summer. It definitely wasn't 2 summers ago. We smashed this out, I feel like, in like 6 months.
No way. Well, I'm looking... There was an upload of episode 1 in December 23. So that's a year ago. It was at least a year ago. I thought it was 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to have a look. I'll have a look. But anyway, Jamie, have we got anything else to add? There's been no exciting F1 news.
Well, Hamilton
there?
Dropped the coldest photo of the year, so that's quite cool.
Oh, yeah. Of course he
outside,
did.
Outside Maranello factory. And looking like a mafia boss. But
he doesn't look like a mafia boss. He's just wearing what Enzo Ferrari used to wear.
It is true. Very cool. And I'm quite excited to see him driving a Ferrari in 2025.
Can we appreciate that post has been up now, I think, for just under 10 hours. And it's got 4 million likes. Like, Hamilton
mental.
Absolutely is bigger than the sport.
That is
just insane.
We'll have to
just
see.
Insane.
I think the sport is fine without him. But it might lose some popularity.
Yeah, exactly. How many followers has F1 got on Instagram, sorry? Just out of interest?
On Twitter, they've got 10.8.
No, I meant on Instagram. So Hamilton's got 38.6 million Instagram followers. F1 has 32 million.
That's actually close than I thought. But I guarantee you that, like, the amount of footballers who have more followers than FIFA do would be great.
Oh, yeah. I'm just going to put this out there as well, Jamie, for you. Max Verstappen, 13.5 million followers.
Yeah, because he's a family man. He doesn't care about his social media.
He's a family man. He just spends all his time on his sim rig.
He has got a dog. Absolutely... That's another bit of news. There you go.
Has he?
He has. And it's not called Liam Lawson. Not yet.
Oh, so, dearie me.
There's some news from the Verstappen household.
Well, I guess we should finish off it. We should round this off before we keep rambling about random stuff. if we do another one of these icebergs down the line, tell us down in the comments what you would like featured in it. Because that would be really, really ideal as well and useful.
You can give us a knowing wheel iceberg. If there's things that we did three
years
ago...
If we could do
ago,
a knowing wheel iceberg, yeah.
That you're confused about. That'd be really cool. Like, why did we do one on the phone one time? That was a good question.
Oh, you meant an iceberg about knowing wheel?
Yeah.
Oh, dearie me, that'd be shambolic.
Like, how many venues have I recorded in? I'm sure it would be 20, I think.
Oh, it's going to be a lot. Yeah, you travel around far too much. Mm. But Jamie, as always, it has been a pleasure. Thank you all so much for listening, even to all our rambles right at the end of that. And I mean, we've got still, what, 2 months? But we've got a month before the car reveals start happening, which
month.
I guess will be good.
We've then we've got a lot of filling testing.
We've got winter testing not long after that. We are getting there. We are definitely getting there. We'll have a few more kind of rambling.
Stay strong,
podcasts.
We can do it.
Exactly. We're all in this together, as my old mate Troy in the basketball court would say.
Oh, what a guy.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll be back very soon with more Knowing Wheel.